Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Yeah, here's Peter.
Yeah, and we're in the holiday mood here.
We are. We're getting ready for, we're very much in a holiday frame of mind. In fact, those of you who haven't made up your mind what you're doing for Christmas yet might want to follow in the footstep that On the Menu's thinking about. We thought about where would be a nice place to go for Christmas. Somehow or other, New Orleans, Louisiana crossed our screen. Across our mental screen. I guess the French call New Year's Réveillon.
Réveillon, yeah.
But the tradition in New Orleans is that they do Réveillon, special menus for Réveillon, all across the Christmas period, from before Christmas until after New Year's. So we're working on some things right now, and we might find ourselves there. A tip for those of you who are budget-minded is that airfares are very modest, and accommodation, the city's obviously not busy. We need to support them. Lots of people have asked us, from down there, please come on down. Hotel rates are very attractive.
And they are.
And I was just talking to someone at the Windsor Court Hotel, which is a place we might stay, and she said, have you ever been in New Orleans for Christmas time?
No, we
and we
not.
Said no. And she said, it's marvelous. The French Quarter is all decorated. It's just delightful. So
yeah, Marcy said that her dad would take her there every year, the week before Christmas.
So we're thinking about that, and you might want to think about it too. And in the meantime,
we have lots of really great interviews.
Back to the program.
Yeah, we have top stars today, starting with our friend Thomas Keller, who is a remarkable man and chef, and he's written a wonderful book. It's the best description explanation of this technique called sous vide that I have ever read. His book is a masterpiece, and it's called Under Pressure. So let's listen to Thomas.
Thomas Keller is the chef owner of French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon Bakery, and it goes on, doesn't it, Thomas? Welcome.
Well, it's good to be here, and good to talking to you again.
Yeah, well, it's been a while. I said when I first picked up the phone, this book, you really did it this time, it's called Under Pressure, Cooking Sous Vide, which is one of the hottest techniques going anymore, and it's a masterpiece. It's so simple. I can't imagine why now anybody will understand. Why bother with a technique like that that requires special equipment? Congratulations on this.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Now, why don't we begin by just saying that Harold McGee, who's a food scientist extraordinaire, he introduces it at the front of the book as one of the most important culinary inventions of modern times. Now, that's a mouthful, and that's saying a lot. Could you explain what the technique is, the science of it?
Well, really, it's... It allows us, as professionals, or anybody really, when we think about cooking, conventional cooking, we're always talking about time and temperature. How long it take to cook something, and for how long, and at what temperature do you want to cook that specific thing? Well, what we've been able to do with these pieces of equipment, number one, the immersion circulator, which helps us a great deal in the time temperature, allows us to cook things at very, very, very specific temperatures, down to a tenth of a centigrade or a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit. The sous vide, or the vacuum packing machine, which we're all very familiar with sous vide. We see it every day. Boiling a bag, I think, is probably one of the easiest ways to describe it. But you see sous vide, cold cuts, they even sous vide lettuce greens. But the plastic, to put something in plastic and vacuum pack it and cook it in water, because as we all know, water allows heat transfer better than any other type of cooking today. So with the immersion circulator, with the vacuum packing machine, and with the water, we're allowed to cook things at a very, very precise temperature for a very precise amount of time, resulting in an extraordinary product.
Now, you have, of course, to practice a fair amount to know exactly how long to cook it and what temperature, so you missed that part out.
Well, I think it's like, it's like anything that you're cooking. Every cooking technique requires practice, and this is just like anything else. It doesn't replace conventional cooking for us. It augments it. It gives us another technique to play with now.
Right. Now, you were very clear in your description of the benefits of this technique, and also
what you should use it for and what you shouldn't use it for. Can you give some examples?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly some of the benefits, there are many, many benefits from storage, you know, obviously one of them. But just talking about the cooking benefits, the enhancement of the flavor of vegetables, for example, which to me is such a revolutionary application, cooking vegetables. And when I speak of vegetables, I'm not speaking of green vegetables. I'm speaking of other types of vegetables, artichokes, onions, potatoes, anything that we're cooking now in sous vide as it relates to our vegetables. The impact and flavor has been impacted tremendously. The flavors of those vegetables, none of the flavor is escaping. Whether it's through steam, whether it's through roasting or evaporation, it's all maintained within that bag. So the flavor is enhanced tremendously. That's one of the things that we're able to do with sous vide cooking. Obviously, some of the things that you don't want to do with sous vide cooking is green vegetables.
Now, why is that?
Well, because the gas that lies underneath the skin of the green vegetables and escapes in the boiling process, which maintains the bright, vivid color green. If there's nowhere for that gas to escape, then of course the vegetables turn brown. We've all seen that happen before when you cook green beans in a covered pot, for example, and the gases can't escape. They're put back into the water and then therefore resulting in a brown vegetable.
I never knew that. Such a simple thing. I learn something, Thomas, every time I talk to you that I didn't know before.
Well, thank you.
But this technique isn't exactly new. So you give a little bit of its history, but for our listeners, perhaps they would like to hear that.
Sure. The technique was developed in the 30s by Hills Brothers Coffee Company to vacuum pack coffee, keep it fresher. I think a lot of us, certainly, you know, people my age and older, realized it in the 50s when a company called Cryovac started vacuum packing turkeys. And of course freezing them, and then, of course we saw turkeys now that are available year round in our grocery stores. Up until that point, that wasn't available. In the 1970s, two French scientists, one Michel Parlus and the other Bruno Gosseau, started to work with specific chefs on specific techniques. Michel started working with Chef Toigro on cooking foie gras, and Bruno started working with Chef Robuchon on developing an entire menu, an entire repertoire for the French National Railroad. In order to have high-quality food that's associated with a three-star chef, Jules Robuchon, served on a speeding train. And it was at the end of the 1990s that we started to really experiment with sous vide cooking, and we became associated with Bruno Gosseau through his company Cuisine Solutions, and then a division called Five Leaf that is marketing chefs' recipes through the type of cooking where you can actually buy some recipes or buy some dishes that were created by likes of Daniel Blue, Mark Miller, Charlie Trotter, and of course myself, where you can buy these boil-in-a-bag recipes or dishes that we had created for that. But the most important thing that came out of that wasn't necessarily the recipes that we did it or the marketing of the dishes that they've done, but the knowledge that we gained at our restaurants in order to really understand the different ways that sous vide could benefit what we were doing in the restaurant.
Now the vacuum packing you're talking about here, but the heat circulating machines that give you such control over temperature, aren't they a little bit newer?
Well, no, those have been used in the medical. Well, they are a little newer.
They're newer in cooking.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. You're absolutely right. What we've been able to do in the immersion circulators. So just to give you our broader definition of sous vide is not necessarily only things that are cooked in plastic or things that we use in the vacuum machine. We define sous vide in our restaurant, which is in a way that encompasses the immersion circulator as well. So we cook things in the immersion circulator. It's not technically sous vide, but it falls under that umbrella of this new type of cooking for us. So the immersion circulator has been something that's been used in the medical industry for years to maintain specific temperatures while they incubate bacteria in petri dishes, for example. We're using that to generate a specific temperature in a water bath. And the wonderful thing about these is they're portable, so we can move them around the kitchen, move them around the country if we want to.
Wiley Dufresne had one, but we saw it in his kitchen that he actually got from a chemistry lab. I think it wasn't a food oriented one
it
at all.
It was a medical lab.
It was a medical lab, piece of medical lab equipment. Just
that was
as
a
you're
while
describing.
Ago.
Yeah. It was
yeah,
about
yeah.
Five or six years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah, but and they still are, and that's where we get ours from.
But they're really costly. Thomas, I've been so itching to try this technique, but, you know, it's a very expensive investment to buy an immersion circulator, right?
Right.
Now, do you think that we're going to see this equipment become more cost-effective for home cooks?
I think so. I think you'll see it very soon. I know companies are working on that right now to introduce into the home kitchen. And if you think of the microwave, 25 years ago when it was first introduced, it was something that was very rare. And now today, kitchens are come equipped. A standard piece of equipment is a microwave oven.
Yeah, I've never thought that really realized its potential. I mean, what it was supposed to be. I don't use it.
Yeah. I think that the immersion circulators will become integrated in the home kitchens, to where you will be able to purchase products that are produced from different companies and be able to take them home and actually heat them up in your immersion circulators.
Now, one of the things that you do in the book, Thomas, that's so intriguing is you bring together ingredients that don't necessarily spring to mind as being side by side, and as a result of cooking them together, you get some kind of catalytic event that takes place in terms of the flavor.
Uh-huh.
Am I sensing that correctly?
Well, I think that there's that way that happens in the bag, but there's also that way that happens when we cook conventionally.
Conventionally, anyway, yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Now, I think you also talk about compressing things as well, though.
Right.
You haven't talked about that so
far.
Oh,
yeah, I wanted to ask about that because you refer to this chamber vacuum. I mean, I have to tell you, when I first got my little vacuum machine, the first thing I did was I had this big loaf of rustic Italian bread. And we put it under vacuum. It was hysterical.
She proceeded to extract all the air from the bread.
and then,
so we didn't do that again.
And then the other one was I had an octopus, and it was hysterical. It looked like a two-dimensional cardboard cutout of an octopus. All the little suckers even got flattened out.
But it cooked up beautifully.
It did. But I'm thinking that having more control, as you suggest, these chamber vacuums, you could then apply an amount of pressure more appropriate to the delicacy of the product you're dealing with, right?
Well, that's absolutely true. As I said, there are many different types of chamber machines that are manufactured by different companies. They go anywhere from what they call a gas flush machine, where they replace the oxygen, they extract the oxygen from the bag, but they replace it with nitrogen, which is an inert gas, and they'll use those when they want to cryovac or vacuum herbs or lettuces.
Oh, okay.
So they do that. That's the way that's done in a chamber machine, by replacing the two gases, one removing the oxygen and replacing it with nitrogen. For us, we're not really using it for those purposes. We're using it, primarily to cook in, or as you say, compress in, or store things in. Compression is very interesting because you'll take it first became aware of it when we first compressed a piece of watermelon. And we all know what a piece of watermelon looks like and what a piece of watermelon tastes like. When it's compressed to remove all the air, it becomes very, very dense. The color is magnified, 20 times. So it really looked like a beautiful piece of sashimi tuna.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you have wonderful photographs I might mention in the book that illustrates these what you're talking about.
So compression has been a lot of fun for us, and that happens immediately as soon as the vacuum machine has finished its cycle. The product is compressed, whether it's a cucumber, a melon, a tomato, whatever we're compressing.
Cherries.
Now, do you actually press it? I mean, there's a device that also squeezes it, or does the vacuuming do that?
The vacuuming does that by removing all the air and then compressing around. Then the air is once removed, and the bag is compressed through that vacuum.
Now we have a patent on compressing bread, by the way. So if you stop putting that on your menu, you'll be in trouble with your diners too, because I can tell you we took it out of the package and we tried to eat it, and it was just impossible.
It was funny. It was
I can imagine.
Yeah. Now you say two things I wanted to address here. One, you're discussing. Well, you're always so philosophical anyhow, but you're discussing emotions as regards to cooking.
Mm-hmm.
That one of the things that you could see in sous vide was that you could lose the sense, the emotional involvement with the craft and the soul.
Right, we call it
the
craft
soul.
Of cooking, and when, sous vide is something that becomes so precise, we can cook a saddle of Keith Martin's lamb, for example.
Yeah.
It takes us for 50 minutes at 61.5 degrees to cook that saddle of lamb on the bone, medium rare. Now, no longer does the chef have to know, has to finesse the cooking, has to be able to feel the meat to understand when it's done, to feel the meat to understand when to take it out of the oven, to understand how hot his oven is. All the different elements that come into a person's consciousness when they're cooking, that's removed because because you're just dropping in the tank of water and cooking it and cooking it for a specific amount of time at a specific temperature, knowing that it's going to come out medium rare at the end.
Yeah.
So we don't want to lose that. I mean, it's something that, you know, I'm very concerned about. I want to make sure that our young chefs are able to maintain the knowledge and the techniques that are needed to be able to cook a saddle of lamb medium rare without benefit of an immersion circulator or a vacuum machine.
Now, you mentioned in your book, though, that there are some things that just don't do well sous vide. So can you give us some examples of that? I mean, there are things that that should be braised because it does something to them that sous vide doesn't do.
Well, I think that, you know, when you're talking about braising, certain types of meats on the bones, which are somewhat difficult to cook in sous vide, but not impossible. But I think the action, it's more about the action of the cooking, the nuances of the aromas that you smell, that you lose all that when you're cooking in sous vide. There is no aroma anymore. You don't hear the sounds that you do when you're cooking, when you're starting to brown off your vegetables and your meats. You don't have that opportunity to feel that connection with the food as we do, and that's such a magical thing to do, to be able to braise a beautiful piece of meat, because it does go through so a transition to become from something that's very tough and to something that's very tender and succulent.
Now, these recipes are are you really targeting the home chef? I mean, first of all, the home chef would have to buy the necessary equipment. The ingredients are, now you say where you can get them all, but they're certainly not something that would be in...
And they're in metric, are they not?
But they wouldn't necessarily be in our pantry, and our pantry is larger than most people's.
Right. Well, this book was written for the professional cook.
Oh, it was, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it's because of the equipment that's needed, because of the technology that you have to have, it's something that I wanted to really target to the professional. It's such a new, I don't say it's such a new technique, but it's a new technique to many young cooks, many young chefs, and I wanted to give them this information so that they, once they begin the process of exploring this, of experimenting with it, they had a tool, they had this book to be able to use so they can guide them through the process.
Well, I think the other thing you've done is to show them the immense range of products that could be brought together, vast range of ingredients and the juxtapositions of ingredients in unusual ways.
And the valuable applications section is very good.
Now, the one that I did smile about was the tripe recipe where at the bottom it says service 50.
It's hard to cook tripe for six.
most of your quantities produce dishes in slightly smaller numbers.
Yeah.
Is that someone's like, that's a joke?
Well, it's, you know, when we buy tripe, you know, we buy, you know, in 10 pound cases. So it's
okay.
Really, you know.
So you can't just go to your friendly neighborhood butcher and say, I'd like a pound of tripe because I'm cutting Thomas Carr's recipe
by
10.
You could. I mean, if you certainly want to experiment with that recipe and you have the equipment, you certainly could.
Well, now, I want to point out that you also give all of your chefs recognition in this book, which is... this is one of your traits that you do. You don't take all the credit yourself, and they've worked on sous vide quite a lot at two restaurants, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jonathan Benno came to me 3 years ago and said, "Chef, we have to write the first English sous vide book," and that's kind of what the genesis was. And of course, you know, getting Corey Lee involved from the French Laundry was very important. So we had Corey and Jonathan who were cooking at the same levels, the same philosophical approaches, the same culture, and working together with me and on these recipes. And of course, we needed to have something for dessert, which, you know, when you talk about sous vide applications being the least impactful, it's probably in dessert. But certainly we wanted to make this a well-rounded book, so bringing some desserts in. Of course, Sebastian Roxel, who's been our pastry chef for the past 10 years.
Yeah, the custard sounds so simple.
Now, your old friend from the French Laundry was on the program not too long ago. He's at the CIA. Is he at the CIA now?
Stephen.
You mean the
frozen dessert guy.
Frozen dessert.
Oh, Francisco.
Yes, he was
Francisco.
On the...
Francisco Magoya.
He was on the program just a few weeks ago.
He was
wonderful book he wrote.
That's what he talked to us about. But... I did want to recap one thing for listeners, because it comes out of what we were just talking about. Because when I talked to you last, when Anne was indisposed and you were in Pittsburgh just a little more than a year ago, I said, are you still a chef? And you thought about it and you said, well, perhaps I'm really not anymore. I'm a restaurateur, but I'm not a chef. And I said, well, how have you been successful? And you said it's because of my team.
Yeah.
And that's very evident in this book as well. And I think it's just wonderful that that they share the limelight with you.
Well, thank you. I think it's important for them to, for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, because they were such great contributors and collaborators with this book. But number two, it starts to teach them. It starts to give them those opportunities of getting their name out there and starting to feel what it's like to be impactful and to be asked questions and to really be knowledgeable and to be identified as somebody who's knowledgeable about a specific technique, and of course this one being sous vide.
Thomas, one other thing, how are you keeping pace with all this? You're on such a tough schedule.
It's been a little bit of a whirlwind here for the past couple of weeks since the book came out, and with everything that's going on, the holiday season, of course, and the last book I wrote, which is Bouchon, of course, we hadn't gone through the expansion process, so we didn't have Persei in New York, and we didn't have Bouchon in Las Vegas, so it was a little, I think, a little easier to control back then. But certainly it's...
That's an easy book to use, by the way, I must say.
Thank you.
I have to admit, I have really not cooked anything out of the French Laundry cookbook, except maybe little items.
There you go.
What I mean.
But we do have a new tongue recipe. You have a tongue recipe. We don't have a machine to make it, but I do have a new brine for tongue.
Oh, good.
So that's in this book.
In this book. We can use that.
No reason it shouldn't work in a conventional manner, right?
You still, not at all. It comes out to be a beautiful tongue.
But you have to brine it for 28 days. I don't know if you didn't.
Well,
that's based on the tongue that we did at the French Laundry, I think. Hillary's tongue, which was Eric Siebold's mother's.
that's exactly the one you refer to.
Yes.
Eric
Siebold's mother's tongue.
Yeah, we got a tongue as part of a potluck, extractive part of a cow.
Yeah. And we
were trying to find a recipe for it, and fortunately,
Ann Willen
country French cooking came through. But now we have another one to try. So now all we have to do is see where we can find another tongue.
that'll be a good one.
I have one question that's kind of burning. Is why is the health department at odds with this?
Well, because there is bacteria, and you talk about the anaerobic bacteria that's developed in an environment where there's no oxygen.
Yeah, so that's kind of scary. Yeah,
they're really, really worried about that, and rightly so. And I think that it's very important that it be addressed right from the beginning, and that's why we developed a HACCP program working within the New York City Environmental Health Department. Bruno Gosseau came up and worked with us with the Environmental Health Department so they can learn about it. They really needed to learn about it. They didn't understand it. They didn't understand the process. They didn't understand the technique. They didn't understand what needed to be done, what we had to be aware of and avoid.
But you've used...
So we went through that process and developed that program. And now we've been approved by the New York City Health Department for the sous vide cooking.
And you outline safety techniques and
very important
steps for safety in this book.
Very important.
Now, well, one last thing, listeners. It's just by way of a little bit of a joke for the time of year. We know Thomas is in Washington D.C. talking to us right now, but there is no truth to rumors that he is going to be part of the new administration. there isn't a job that's big enough.
I want our new president-elect to put a culinary garden at the White House.
Hey, that's not a bad idea. Can we campaign for that?
Yeah, we should all campaign for that.
That would be good.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Thomas.
Once again, a
delight to talk to you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Thomas. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And with that, I think it's time we should take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're moving along with yet another delightful interview with, this is my favorite restaurant in Manhattan. It's called
Bernardin. Thomas Kelly, you say that.
Well, I've never been in per se.
Because you can't get in there.
You can't get in per se. Well, you may now.
The Bernardin's a pretty tough table, but per se's in the tends to be in the impossible range. And we've asked Thomas a number of times, can't he help us to get in? And he says, I don't get involved in that, and I can't say I blame him. Anyway, it was a delight.
I loved the last year when we tried to get into Vetri's at New Year's Eve. And Mark said to us, I can't even get my father in.
So anyway,
here we have Eric Repair.
Yeah, we caught up with Eric. Eric was in Los Angeles, of all places, when we caught up with him. But we had a wonderful chat with him about a new book project and about the whole Le Bernardin thing and a little bit about its future as well. So if you're interested in knowing the secret about what might happen in that particularly interesting part of the New York City restaurant scene, stay tuned. Here we go.
Eric Repair is the renowned chef of an equally renowned restaurant, Le Bernardin, in Manhattan. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
Now, Eric, you wrote a book called On the Line, The Stations, The Heat, The Cooks, The Cost, The Chaos, and The Triumphs of a Day in the in Your Restaurant. My first question when I first saw the book was, why did it take you and Le Bernardin so long to write a cook?
I wrote a couple of cookbooks in the past. One of them was called A Return to Cooking.
Okay.
And it was more like an experimentation with other artists in connection with seasons. And then Le Bernardin had a cookbook in 1995 called Le Bernardin Four Star Simplicity. But I wanted to do On the Line because I wanted to create a documentary of the team, on the life, the team at Le Bernardin, and I wanted to do it in written. So we created this book, and it's basically a VIP pass to go backstage.
Yes, and it's really exciting. There are parts that are just amazing. The average person, as enthralled as everyone is with food and the culinary world, nobody has an idea of the kind of perfection that goes on every day by so many people at Le Bernardin.
I will hope that nobody, no client will have an idea, because it will mean that they will really struggle with their lunch or dinner.
That's for sure.
It's a little bit like a duck. It's calm on the surface, but there's lots of pedaling going on under the water.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Now, you have a little biographical information in the book as well, in the introduction to the book. Did I read correctly that even when you were starting out, you had your eye on stardom? You wanted to be noticed?
Well, yes, I wanted to be noticed when I was a young cook. And my idol at the time was Paul Bocuse.
Right.
And I wanted to be recognized not just to be a celebrity chef or a celebrity, but I wanted to be recognized for my craft, for my work.
Uh-huh. Well, we certainly are that, that's for sure.
Yeah. I've been lucky, I'll say.
Oh, now, tell me this. I have to ask this. You know I have to ask this. As you indicate that one of the reasons you wrote this book is because your lease is coming up in 2011. Are you telling us that we should read between the lines?
No, but I'm saying that it's going to be a decision that I have to make. And either way, in 2011, Le Bernardin will go on the way it is for several more years, or won't. And we haven't taken the decision yet.
You haven't?
No.
I mean, I would think that probably after all this time, you might be ready to go in another direction, no?
It could be, but you know, I'm very passionate about Le Bernardin. I really enjoy being part of the team and creating what we create today at the restaurant. And it's true that I am tempted to do other things. So I don't know. We'll see. I have a few years to think about.
Right. Well, you go on about team. You're a team player, and you're big on the team, right?
Yes, because without a team, by yourself, you cannot really do much when you think that you have to serve about 100 people at the same time and have some private rooms being filled also. And so you definitely need a team that is going to support the vision. And I have an amazing team. They have been very loyal and dedicated to create with me what Le Bernardin is today.
Yeah, and you really give them a lot of voice in this book, too. And so, listeners, if you want to know who's behind all the wonderful, perfect dishes that you're receiving at Le Bernardin, you'll enjoy getting to know these people on Eric's team. I find it amazing that you turn out 1,200 dishes a day, and you fill an order. An order goes out every 15 to 30 seconds, and you're able to maintain that kind of quality. It's astounding. And you said 40 cooks in an old kitchen.
Yes, we have about 41 cooks, and altogether we are 140 employees in care of the restaurant.
And seating how many?
Well, we can sit downstairs about 100, 110 at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And we open for lunch and dinner days a week. And we have also private rooms that can accommodate up to 100 people as well.
And I think that the timeline is really one the big interest of the book, like how the day starts and who arrives and what happens, and followed all the way through to where the washer comes in and cleans up the kitchens. But the glossary is also interesting for people who want to sort of get to know that all the terminology of like the past and so forth. It's become so common in our culture, foodie culture. So I think that's a very useful feature.
Yes, I think so too. We sharing the vocabulary that we use with the reader, and some of the vocabulary we use is common in the food industry. Some of it's mostly Le Bernardin slang, I would call. And
yeah, there's one I can't remember what it was that I was amazed at because I'd never heard it. You have it in the book, some slang from Le Bernardin.
Yes, well, we call the front of the stove uptown.
Oh, that's
and
it.
The back of the stove downtown.
Downtown. That I thought was unusual. You know, can you join me in a campaign to get rid of this American usage of entree?
Entree for
main courses.
Main course?
I can't stand it. You know, I wrote. Go ahead.
I'm still confused. I confuse in between the French and the American very often myself.
I mean, it's how did it happen? I don't know how we got to this thing with the entree. It clearly should be the appetizer.
Yes. It's maybe someone made a mistake a long time ago, and then we all picked up on it and didn't change it.
Maybe it's just the entree to dessert, and that's the reason why. So it's the introduction to the most important part of the meal.
That could be true.
You have a bunch of tips also, such as this testing doneness with the metal skewer and then putting it on your face.
Well, not necessarily on your face, but on your chin, because the chin is fairly sensitive, and we use skewers, metal skewers, because they diffuse the heat pretty well. And if the skewer comes back when we insert it through the flesh of the fish, when it comes back, if it's really hot, it means the fish is overcooked. When it's cold, it means it's not cooked, and when it's warm, it's cooked to perfection.
That's brilliant. That's wonderful.
It's very basic, but it works.
Yes. You have a lot of tips in a book like that, and it's like sauce secrets where you clarify with the egg whites and so forth. It's taken a while to get to this point, isn't it?
To this point, what do you mean by that?
Of everything at such an incredibly meticulous level, and everybody plays by the same rules.
Yes. Absolutely. It's kind of I see this book almost as a legacy, so it took my entire life to really be able to be at the level where we are today, and the book really is witnessing that progress, acknowledge what we do today at the level of where we are.
Yeah. Now, what do you feel that you would like to have done or you would still like to do that you haven't done to this point?
It's a hard question, this one. I think I have done in my life whatever I wanted, really. I have been very lucky, and any vision that I had has materialized. I have been rewarded for it, and I'm still having tremendous fun with what we do at Le Bernardin, and it's really a dream come true.
Now, let Peter ask a question, Anne got all researched here, and of course he's much more organized than I am. But one of the things that interests me is what does it feel like to be so famous? I mean, the chef as a superstar was very well written up by Michael Ruhlman, who I think is probably a good friend of yours, in one of his books. And you're talking to us very humbly, and not a little bit the star, but most people will know Eric Ripert, the incredibly handsome young man who is recognizable wherever he goes. Does that make you comfortable, uncomfortable? What's it like?
Well, First of all, being perceived as a good-looking man doesn't really help in the kitchen.
No, but it must be kind of different. It must be kind of different on the street. I mean, do you get recognized on the street? I mean, does that?
Yeah, I don't. You know, I don't really see the famous aspects. I you know, every morning I leave my house, I walk through Central Park for 45 minutes, and I go to work. I barely see anyone in the park at that time, and you know, sooner you enter your kitchen or the restaurant, it's no glamour. I have to deal with the reality of the life of the restaurant, and it's certainly not glamorous at all. And I'm interacting with the team. Obviously, I'm interacting with the clients during lunch and dinner, and you know, we have some fun dialogues in between clients and I. But I don't feel pardon. I don't feel anything like that in my life. I have a very simple life, and nobody stops in the street to make me sign an autograph.
Oh no! I would think you're so distinctive looking that you would have that happen.
That hasn't happened. I don't have a I don't have to leave Le Bernardin through the back door because it's a group is waiting for me.
What about Todd English? I think he probably has groupies.
maybe Todd. I don't know. We have to ask him, but it doesn't happen to me.
I see.
Now, this is for those people, of course, who are living on another planet, we should note that Le Bernardin is, of course, in New York City, and it's on West 57th Street, I think.
Yes.
And it's one of the unique things about it is that it serves almost entirely seafood, but you do have one meat on your menu, and it turns out it's produced by a friend of ours, not more than 50 miles from here.
Oh, yes?
I'm talking about John Jamison, John and Suki Jamison's lamb.
For sure, yes, yes.
Actually, their daughter did a stage with you, didn't she?
I think she did.
She did.
Eliza.
She worked for us.
Oh, she worked for you, Eliza.
She was in our staff.
Right, yeah.
So what made you create that unusual exception?
Because by respect for clients and for convenience, because sometimes we have big tables coming to Le Bernardin, and the 6 or 8 or 10 people, and the host knows that we are serving mostly only seafood, but some of the guests are not necessarily aware, and some of them dislike seafood, so we don't want to impose on them.
Okay.
What do you deal with? I just read an article saying that bluefin tuna is now on the endangered list. How do you manage to keep your fish choices up there, and there are certain favorites I'm sure that everybody would expect to find, but there's so many cycling off into sustainability issues now.
Yes, well, we are very sensitive to what's going on in the world, and we have a close relationship with organizations that are monitoring the species, and when one fish is endangered, we actually write on our menu that we do not serve that species.
Uh-huh.
On our menu, I think right now we have about 5 or 6 different fishes that we are listing, saying, you know, those fishes are on the verge of disappearing.
Oh, I'm sure that the numbers are going up and up and up, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's gotten just gross, I think. And talking about numbers...
Well, you know, governments, when they are pressured properly and educated, they really do a good job in opening and closing fisheries, in regulating in the strongest way what's going on. So I'm hopeful, really, at the end of the day, I'm hopeful that in between the organization pressuring governments and knowledgeable people, the fish will be okay in a few years from now and actually not disappearing.
Eric, the obvious question here is, to me it is an obvious question, is like, I know who some of the people you hang with, but like, who are your heroes currently? I know about Bocuse, but what about now?
Well, I admire very, very much Joël Robuchon.
Oh, yes, he's wonderful.
I'm sorry?
I said he's wonderful, yeah.
Yes.
Mashed potatoes.
It's incredible. So Joël Robuchon is definitely on top of the list. And I have, you know, a lot of respect for Thomas Keller and for Daniel and for Jean-Georges.
Oh, great,
You know, and in a new generation of chefs like Grant Achams in Chicago. I mean, I respect and I admire nice people who have talent.
And I was going to ask you also, when you have all these people, you get endless numbers of requests for employment and so forth. How do you, you mentioned in your book about what you're looking for, but how do you identify in these very young chefs who really has the talent, who's gifted?
Well, you never really know at the interview, but what we're looking for is, first of all, people who come for interviews most of the time have been recommended by other chefs, and then we want to make sure that they are humble, hardworking, clean, and we want to make sure that they can be a team player. And then, if we see that in them, then we are willing to teach them, pass the knowledge to them,
and to mentor them and so forth. And what do you see in our future for the? Is there a new type of restaurant like the casual, small, like David Chang's? I mean, where do you think we're going with the restaurant industry?
Well, I think, the restaurant industry is always going to have casual places and always places to celebrate in a more official way or serious way. And you always will have luxurious restaurants with more formality and restaurants with less formality. And I don't see the industry really alienating itself from one aspect of the spectrum to another. I see the industry as a whole with all those different components. And it's true that casual will be more and more, because more and more people go out to restaurants on a daily basis almost in the big cities. And then the formal restaurants are actually in New York City, for instance, are very busy despite the recession. The luxurious restaurants are doing well because it's always business going on. It's always people who want to celebrate with style.
Right. Well, I guess we'll wait and see then. And we'll wait till 2011 to see what happens at Bernadette and what happens with Eric Repair. And in the meantime, listeners, you can go to On the Menu Radio and order the book called On the Line, and it's on our OTM bookshelf. Good luck with your book, Eric, and I don't know what's taken us so long to actually get together and talk.
Well, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate the conversation, and I hope we will have many more.
Oh, that's great. I like that. Thank you so much, Eric.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's always fun. He has such a good sense of humor. And now I think it's time we pause once more.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We are here once more. I forgot to give you our email. So
yeah, we
should
say welcome back. We forgot welcome back.
No, I said welcome back.
Oh, no, you didn't, but that's all right. You're being...
Well, I am welcoming them back, and I wanted to put our email out there so that anybody interested in sending us season's greetings or comments can do so. onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com will get to us.
And don't forget our blog at... onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Right.
There we go. We're all over the place.
Yeah. And now we have another chef.
We're a cyber...
Chefs, I don't know how they...
We're a cyber... all get out. Well, we stayed in New York.
Yeah, with all these chefs.
The common thread.
No, Jason Denton is... he's with a number of restaurants. He's his fingers in a number of pies. And he writes these eminently useful cookbooks. This one called Simple Italian Snacks. Well, let's just listen to him explain his concept for this
book.
Well,
let's also, before we go into it, let's note that his first dining establishment was called Eno.
And then
they have an expansion of that called Enoteca, and they've just opened another.
And there was Lupa, don't forget Lupa.
Yeah, and then a really exciting new place that we're hoping to visit in January called Bar Milano.
Bar Milano, that's
And he talks about some of that, but also about the inspiration that's behind his very interesting new book, which is called Small Italian...
Simple Italian Snacks.
Simple Italian Snacks. There you go. What could be wrong with that just in time for Christmas?
Jason Denton has actually been on our show before with a previous book. How to introduce you, Jason. You have so many things going on at once. You have restaurants in Manhattan. You have a lot of restaurants in Manhattan. Why don't you tell us what those are?
Well, I'm partners in a place that I opened with my wife about 10 years ago, which is how the first book came about, and it's called Eno. It's a little panini bar and bruschetteria. I'm also partners with Mario and Joe in a restaurant called Lupa, Osteria Romana. And then I have another restaurant that I have with my brother and my partner, Eric, Kleinman called Enoteca, and then most recently we opened up a restaurant called Bar Milano.
Which is supposed to be hot.
Up on 24th and 3rd. We're having a lot of fun with it. We just, you know, it opened up in the springtime, and yeah.
Yeah, and that's Northern Italian, you said?
We specialize in Northern Italian cuisine.
But, but Jason's a man of many parts as well, so let's just not forget to mention that. Called us about an hour ago and said, I have to put off the interview for an hour because I have a crisis. Why didn't you explain the crisis?
Yeah, my crisis was making gingerbread cookies with my son's first grade class. They got pushed back and, you know,
so
had to deal with that.
Yeah,
so
we understand that.
So here's a guy who has his heart in the right place. I shared with him that during the time he was putting the interview off, I was making chili, and I had a crisis too, but we both completed our crises, and here we are.
And we're going to be talking about his new book, which is called Simple Italian Snacks, More Recipes from America's Favorite Panini Bar. Jason, how does this differ from your Simple Italian Sandwiches, which is the book we interviewed you about last time?
Right. Well, I think it's a great question because I was thinking about that earlier, and where I think it kind of differentiates is the same way that my restaurants, Eno and Enoteca, differentiate, because I think it's just it's Eno plus a bit more. So in the same way this has simple Italian sandwiches and the, you know, it has the panini, the tramezzini, the bruschette, it also has some small plates that we've really kind of really worked hard with at Enoteca to develop, and it has a little fritto, which are little fried dishes, and you know, my take on simple pizza recipes. You know, I think people get so caught up in pizza and all the, you know, specialized recipes and how it's exactly supposed to be. My interpretation is just a real straightforward, simple olive oil and salt dough with a little bit of yeast that just kind of lends itself to the ingredients. Like a lot of my cooking, I try not to make it too difficult. I just try to make it taste really good and be fun and easy for someone at home.
Now, we've forgotten the Italian connection, but it's not immediately obvious for someone with the last name of Denton to be so involved with Italy. So can you explain that?
Well, the Italian connection is in my heart. That's about it.
Okay.
My heart and my love for it. You
worked there, didn't you?
But the concept of Eno, my first place, came about when we were traveling. I was at a friend's wedding with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and we stumbled upon this little hole in the wall in Monte Rosa, and it started raining, and we peeked in there, and there was this little old guy, like, grilling panini and serving bruschettas, and the pesto was just so amazing, and we drank some great beer and just kind of sat in this little shop and came back there 5 days in a row and kind of like logged that and said one day we'd like to bring that back to New York City.
So you're an honorary Italian like me.
Exactly.
See, Anne's full-blooded Italian.
I could only hope to be an honorary Italian.
No, I'm sure by now with all these Italian-oriented restaurants and Italian-oriented books, they're probably going to make you the equivalent of a Legion of Honor or whatever it's called.
Well, these recipes, I can see all the traditional elements in it, but you have a big creative swoop with a lot of them too. You take off on the creative side with some traditional things.
Well, I mean, you know, my partner at Lupa, Mario Batali, who's always been a real inspiration in a lot of you know, things that I've done and thought about in Italy, you know, always said it best when I used to work for him a long time ago at Po. It was like taking an Italian chef and putting him here and using the ingredients in the Italian, you know, vein.
Uh-huh.
And so maybe I might not use all the Italian ingredients all the time, but I try to think as they would on a countryside there.
Yeah, I mean, here's one. Peach mascarpone and honey pizza. Now, I've never seen anything like that there.
Yeah, no. I mean, that was that was one of those, you know, when I'm working with Catherine, who wrote the book with me, a lot of times I'll just get some ingredients, and we'll get a glass of wine, and we'll just start cooking. And as I'm going, she'll write things down, and then we'll check it out, and we'll taste it, and we're like, wow, that worked or that didn't. And that was kind of one of those dishes that it was a hot summer day, and the peaches were so delicious, and I was making pizza. I figured, what the heck, we'll just give it a shot.
Now, do you have any recipes of the opposite, ones that you thought were great but didn't make it into the book?
There's always things that you think are going to be perfect that maybe just weren't right for the particular book that you're working on right then or write for the moment, that you can always go back and work on. But yes, I've had, I think with as many that you like, you have to come across ones that you don't like. Otherwise, there would be nothing that would, you know, filter things out.
I think this is a wonderful little cookbook. Look at shrimp panini with pickled red peppers and lemon mayonnaise.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, kind of just our take on like a you know, tuna salad or lobster salad, and just kind of, you know, we wanted to use shrimp. We use that in the restaurant. A lot of these recipes from here are from, you know, dishes that we run at, you know, as an addition or have put on the menu through the years. Or, you know, when we first opened up 10 years ago, we started off with five on the sandwiches, like five bruschette, five tremolini, and five panini. And now we're, you know, say 15 to 20 across the board, plus the salads. And
why don't you explain what a tremolini is?
Well, tremolini is a crustless Italian cocktail sandwich. So it's like basically a Wonder-style bread with the crust cut off. It's like a little English tea sandwich. Where the panini is just in reference to, you know, a sandwich, a little more rustic on ciabatta. You know, when you're in Italy, a lot of places that you go, you know, they'll ask it if you want it heated or cold. You know, they'll have them on display, and then they'll either press it or not.
Right.
For us, we wanted to be just a little bit, I wanted to be a little bit more in control and a little more specific on how the ingredients were dealt with. So a lot of the ingredients are built into this recipe to be grilled. I use a raw portobello mushroom with sun-dried tomato pesto and Parmesan. And if it was served cold, it might not have the impact as if you grill it, and we're not looking to cook anything on the inside, but just kind of warm it through. So when you take a fresh portobello that just gets warmed through with the oils of sun-dried tomato and fresh sliced Parmesan that just slightly starts to melt, I think it really has a nice pop to it. So all of our sandwiches, all of our panini that we serve at Eno and Enoteca are come grilled.
Oh, that's great. No. And tell me this, have you tried any of that buffalo, water buffalo mozzarella?
The Parmesan?
The mozzarella they make in Vermont.
You know what? We have had some samples come through before, and
they're,
I think,
great.
It's delicious.
Yeah, I think it's fabulous.
I agree. I think it's really good.
That's great.
I thought you were going to say Parmesan, because I just the other day had someone brought a sample of a buffalo milk Parmesan.
Really?
That was aged. That was quite quite lovely.
Where was it made?
It was definitely in
America.
And, you know, I want to say Emilia Romagna, but I'm not.
Oh, it's Italian imported.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, while we have you on the line here, why don't you tell us a little bit about your new hotspot, the Bar Milano?
Well, you know, it was just kind of something that we've been thinking about for a couple years. It's a northern Italian restaurant that's kind of split into two rooms, and one room kind of focuses on the bar. And we have, you know, one of my partners is, specializes in cocktails and does a lot of travel.
Who is that?
His name is Tony Abuganim.
Oh, that's sure, because I did an article on cocktails, the new cocktails. So that's how I knew that.
Yeah, so he's one of my partners there and does that whole program. And then my two partners in the kitchen is a gentleman named Steve Connington and Eric Kleinman. Steve used to work for me at Lupa a few years back as a chef when Mark Ladner went to Del Posto. And then Eric is my partner and is a chef over at Enoteca.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they take care of the kitchen, and my brother is my other partner who deals with all the wine and, you know, the service and stuff on the floor. So,
what have you been to the new Montrachet? Well, that's not the new Montrachet.
Oh, the Corton?
Corton.
Corton. I have not been over there. It's been kind of crazy, you know, few months with just work, so I haven't been able to get out nearly as much as I would like.
But Jason, I'm amazed at so many places are opening in this dreadful economy.
Well, I think, just have to continue to move forward and see what works. I don't know, you know, what's going to work over the next year, and there's, you know, continue to do what we do and see what happens.
Yeah, I've just been reading about the vintage dinners that Zagat's are doing.
Oh, yeah?
They're rolling back the clock to, I don't know what, and serving hearts and liver and
they're,
stuff.
They're rolling back the clock to the 1940s and the 1950s, decades that you and I remember, which Jason doesn't even know existed.
Well, please. please.
So anyhow, what's your next book, Jason? You like to write, you said. You really enjoy
I really enjoy doing the books, and my partner in the books, Catherine Kellinger, is just fantastic, and we just have a really good time working together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a couple ideas that we're working with. You know, we love to stay in the vein of Italian, and you know, we did sandwiches and snacks, you know. It might be some version of classics or, you know, entertaining or something. We love the whole approach to the simple Italian part of it.
Yeah, and, I mean, the Italians are great on snacks.
I think so. I really love it. I miss it. I try to go once a year.
Yeah.
And about that 12-month period, I really start to get the itch. And I think it's going to be a little bit longer this year, but I think we plan on
it. Well, we're ahead of you. We went twice this year.
You did. Nice.
We went to Milan.
Nice.
And we had a wonderful visit with the Dottore Boscaino, who runs the Marsi Vineyard. We interviewed him in person.
Oh, great.
And then we went back to Emilia Romana, where we hadn't been for several years, and had a wonderful luncheon with Massimo Bottura.
Love it.
At a place called Osteria Fine, yeah. Francescana.
Yeah, you know it, do you?
I love Emilia Romagna.
Yeah, you got to go again. It was just a wonderful time.
Cool. Yeah, I broke my foot.
Oh, you did?
she always has to rain on somebody's parade.
No, it was quite fine. I mean,
was it after a long lunch?
Yeah,
it was actually on the way to dinner. Wasn't even on the way back.
Yeah. Sure. So anyhow, keep us posted with your writing.
Okay.
And I hope those gingerbread cookies worked out.
I know, we have to.
And we'll do it.
We'll
do a report from the field from Bar Milano.
Oh yeah, if you're there, we can interview while
sometime,
we're there.
Sometime in January.
Anytime you want. I love being on your program. I love your show.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
We'll be in touch and we'll arrange a rendezvous and we'll bring the gear along and we can record about cocktails and all kinds of wonderful adventures.
Oh yeah,
okay,
maybe he'll make wild cocktails.
Hopefully Tony will be around and we can get something worked out. That'd be a lot of fun.
Isn't it a whole new ball game, this cocktail thing?
Sure is.
So anyhow, all right, Jason. You need to go off, and so do we. And it's great talking to you, and Peter will email you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Jason, thanks. Bye.
Well, that was a very profitable program.
What a nice young man Jason Denton is. And then you've got Eric Repair. You would think of Eric as being a sort of a superstar, but he's extraordinarily modest considering his wonderful achievements. All across the culinary scene, but especially, of course, at Ligorius La Bernardin in New York. And what can you say about the iconic Thomas Keller that we haven't already said?
Say that he's really a wonderful human being.
Yeah, he just goes from strength to strength. And the interesting part about both Thomas and Eric is that the thing that they're proudest of is the teams they've created. It's all about teamwork. So, listeners, don't forget, whatever you're doing, yep. It's all about teamwork, and finally, of course, we should let you know in the run-up to Christmas. Of course, we wish you happy holidays. If you have any great ideas about what to do at the Christmas season, don't hesitate to let us know, although I think...
Or any of the other winter holidays, too.
Yeah, for that matter.
There are a whole bunch of them, aren't there?
Yeah, we still have to decide what we're doing for New Year's. we're really organized,
well, I mean,
like we always are.
We have Hanukkah, we have...
We do.
All kinds of things. Yeah.
So, anyway, first version of Happy Holidays from On the Menu to all of you, our listeners.
And I might warn everybody that I'm in the process, as I'm apt to do this time of year, is gathering all these, are they called prognostications for the trends of what to expect in 2009.
So hang on
to your chairs because that'll be coming up soon.
On the Menu's top prognosticator is going to prognosticate as opposed to
masticate
or procrastinate, which is something Anne's also very good at. So whether you get procrastination or prognostication, look for that before the end of the year. And of course, we look forward to seeing you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.